I'm Steve Potter, and welcome to Cityscape. Later in the program, we'll congratulate the co-founders of Third Degree Glass Factory, who tonight will celebrate Third Degree's 10-year anniversary. And St. Louis Art Museum curator Judith Mann previews the new exhibition, Federico Barocci, Renaissance Master, featuring many pieces never seen in this country before. But first, the St. Louis University Library Associates will present the 2012 St. Louis Literary Award to Pulitzer-winning playwright and screenwriter Tony Kushner at a public event at SLU. And now he joins us from Los Angeles. Tony Kushner, welcome to Cityscape.
Thanks.
And I want to let listeners know that you're joining us from a hotel lobby in Los Angeles, so if we hear any music or someone being paged in the background, that explains it.
Right.
First off, though, congratulations on the St. Louis Literary Award.
Well, thank you very much. It's a really lovely honor to receive, and I'm very excited to be coming back to St. Louis.
Yeah, you're in some fine company. Some of the people they've honored in the past include Salman Rushdie, John Updike, August Wilson, Tennessee Williams. I could go on. You're in pretty good company.
I'm overwhelmed. I hope they didn't make a mistake.
I don't think they make mistakes. Speaking of being overwhelmed, let me just go over your resume here briefly. Your play, Angels in America, which was produced not very long ago in St. Louis by Stray Dog Theater, won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Your other plays include A Bright Room Called Day, Homebody Kabul, and the musical Caroline or Change, which was produced on Broadway by St. Louis's own Mike Isaacson, who's the executive producer of the Muni here and a producer for Fox Theatricals.
Yes, I'm very fond of Mike, and he was an extraordinary help. And as the producer of Caroline on Broadway, he did an amazing job. So.
Yeah, and he'll be part of the event on Tuesday, I know, with you.
Yes, that's right.
I might say the Black Rep here in St. Louis also produced Caroline or Change. Another St. Louis connection. You wrote the libretto for Brundabar, which was performed a couple of years ago by Opera Theater here. You also wrote the screenplay for Steven Spielberg's Munich, the movie, and for the soon-to-be-released movie about Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
I think that's due out next month, is it?
Yes, that's why I'm in Los Angeles. We're doing press for the movie right now.
Well, there's a lot of anticipation about that. How do you feel about the finished product now that it's all done?
I'm really, really proud of it. It was a really hard thing to do. I worked on the script for 5 years, I think, and then there's been another year of filming it and post-production, and so it's been a very substantial part of my recent life. But it's also been a transforming experience to work on it, and Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Abraham Lincoln, is astonishing, and we have a really amazing cast of people like Sally Field and Tommy Lee Jones and Joseph Gordon-Levitt and David Strathairn. It's a brilliant company, and I think Stephen has done an astonishing job. I'm very proud of the movie.
That's an incredible cast. You know, many Tony, many of the characters that you write about are marginalized by others or by society, or they're powerless due to, you know, things beyond their control. Do you see Lincoln in that way?
Oh, no, I mean, not at all. Obviously, he was the president of the United States, so it would be hard to describe him as marginalized. One of my concerns, I think, sort of since Aeschylus, one of the concerns of drama has been, you know, the quest for justice in society. And I think theater has certainly always been, and I think film has also followed suit in this, a good place for working out, either explicitly or metaphorically, the struggle for justice or equality or fairness or decency or civilization, all sorts of good things, over forces both external and internal that threaten it. And I feel like, you know, the struggle that people undertake to liberate themselves, the struggle people undertake to liberate others, has always been compelling to me as somebody who reads history and is inspired by and excited by those kind of struggles and the fact that they very often succeed. I think it's all too easy to sort of look at history and see a record of defeat and despair, but I think with a slightly different perspective, you can also find, you know, many instances where people found moral courage and physical courage, political courage, and changed the world. And I've always been drawn to those kinds of stories. So in that sense, Lincoln is, you know, Lincoln's story is one that I find enormously attractive. I didn't suggest to Stephen that we make a movie about Lincoln. He asked me to write the screenplay because he was already thinking about doing it. I don't think I would have ever done it on my own, but I'm glad I did.
Yeah. I read that you were working on a rewrite of the Lincoln script on election night in 2008 as you were watching the returns on TV. What do you remember about that?
I was probably sort of annoyed because I really wanted to just focus on the election and not work. And I was, you know, honestly all but done with the rewrite and just sort of double-checking and making sure that everything was okay before I sent it to Stephen. I had a deadline. But I also felt like it was kind of the perfect thing to be doing because, I think that the situation that Obama inherited when he was first elected is was a country in a crisis. It's not really as grave as the secession crisis. I don't think anything in our country's history really matches that because the country was literally disintegrating. But a very, very serious series of, you know, financial and international military and political calamities that had accumulated under the previous administration. I think that watching this, the first African-American man from Illinois who had declared his run for presidency in Springfield and I knew was a great admirer of Abraham Lincoln's, you know, get elected president, was, you know, an immensely moving thing. And I feel in a lot of ways Obama has followed the Lincoln playbook in his presidency. And, you know, I mean, this is my view and not necessarily representative of anybody else, but I think he's been an absolutely great president. And I'm excited about the fact that he will be reelected, which I feel very confident about.
Yeah. We're talking with Tony Kushner. I've been a little surprised that social issues haven't been addressed more than they have been in the debates. I don't know if you would agree with that or not, but I know, for an example, marriage equality is pretty close to your heart.
Yeah, absolutely. President Obama, as far as I'm concerned, has done everything he needs to do right now for marriage equality, namely declare himself in favor of it. And, how these questions are decided on in these debates and what's really being done in these debates is, I think, a sort of complicated machinery that neither I nor pretty much anybody else except the people directly involved has a real sense of. But while I would really love to see these things discussed openly between these two people, I don't think that it's enormously necessary. I mean, we know, for instance, in terms of marriage equality, that Mitt Romney is opposed to same-sex marriage, favors a constitutional amendment to make it illegal, impossible in the United States. And Barack Obama favors marriage equality. And, yesterday, a very, very conservative judge in the Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals struck down the Defense of Marriage Act as unconstitutional, from what I can see, on 14th Amendment grounds, which is an enormous thing. So, you know, I think the tide of history is very much against people like Mitt Romney in this area and in many areas besides. I mean, I think that anybody who's really listening to these debates can hear exactly what the choices are. I don't tweet, but somebody showed me a tweet from Big Bird, or somebody's calling themselves Big Bird, after the second debate and said, if you think Obama won this debate, retweet this. If you think Romney won this debate, consult a psychiatrist. So pretty much the... a good summation of the proceedings.
Well, you married your partner, Mark Harris, in California. Would that be 3 years ago?
I married Mark, actually. Mark and I got married. We've been married now twice. We were married in New York before marriage was legal in any state other than Massachusetts. We had our own marriage ceremony, and, you know, a rabbi officiated, and we had our family and friends, and that was, I think, in 2005. When Deval Patrick, the extraordinary governor of Massachusetts, got rid of the law that Mitt Romney had supported that had been on the Massachusetts books for many years, saying that you had to be a resident of Massachusetts in order to be married there. And in the same year, the Fifth Circuit Court in New York decided that the New York state constitution explicitly stated that marriages legally performed anywhere else had to be recognized in New York, and that included same-sex marriages.
Right.
This was all in 2007, I believe. We spend a part of a summer every summer in Provincetown on Cape Cod, so we got married by a nice lady cop in the town hall in Provincetown, and that meant we were legally married both in Massachusetts and in New York. You know, we haven't gotten married in California yet. I mean, you know, we can't right now because the court decision on Prop 8 is still pending. But this is exactly what's wrong with this. This is exactly what the Constitution says that nobody should have to do. I mean, now there are challenges to same-sex marriage in several states in this upcoming election, and the LGBT community has to scramble to raise millions of dollars to protect our rights. Uh-huh. Over and over and over again.
Right.
And it places an absolutely unfair burden on us. And even though Mark and I are married in New York, we're not recognized federally. So if one of us is on the other's insurance policy, for instance, that has to be considered a gift.
Right.
From one of us to the other, because the federal government doesn't recognize yet that we have a relationship.
Right. Well, I misspoke about California, but congratulations anyway.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't mean to go on and on.
That's okay. I want to bring up Angels in America because, you know, gee, everybody knows about that. 7 hours, the play 7 hours. I have to tell you a quick little story about my experience. I've never seen it on stage, but it became a very successful miniseries. Was it HBO?
Yeah.
And there was one week, I'm famous, Tony, for not having a long attention span. And so one weekend when I wasn't feeling too well, I rented the DVDs, and I thought that I would watch it an hour or two at a time and through the course of 2 or 3 days. That's how I planned to do it. And when I started watching Angels in America, this is the truth, I watched it all the way through without stopping it.
Oh, wow.
It was so gripping. But did you ever think it was too much, too long?
Oh, you know, not really. I mean, I think that there's a part of it that somewhere in the middle of the second half, the perestroika, which is what the second part is called. I mean, the first part, Millennium Approach, is on stage, certainly, and I think this is true of Mike's film. You know, it's very gripping, and I don't think that any audience that I've ever seen watching it, you know, feels particularly fatigued by it. I think that there is a point during the second half, especially if you're watching it in a marathon, which people really seem to love to do with long plays, to see them all in one day. It's a kind of special experience. Where you do feel a little winded, and then you sort of get back, you get your wind back, and you kind of get through the ending, and the whole thing seems to work. You know, there's this great quote in this line in Horace's, the Roman poet Horace's Ars Poetica, where he says, Even the great Homer nods a little, meaning that even in the Iliad and the Odyssey, there are places where you feel a little sort of fatigued. And I think that that's actually part of the epic, the experience of watching an epic play or reading an epic poem or an epic novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons that it's an epic as opposed to some other form is that it gives you a great journey. It presents you with the experience of a great journey.
There's no
such thing as a heroic journey or a great journey that doesn't include fatigue. The experience of fatigue is actually, I think, part of it.
It's a fatigue in a good way. It's not to be missed.
You should feel a little tired at the end, or you haven't really done your work.
I was exhausted, but in a good way. St. Louis University Library Associates present a conversation with Tony Kushner. It's going to be next Tuesday. There's a book signing at 4:30. The award presentation at 5:30, and a talk led by Mike Isaacson on top of that. It's going to be held at the St. Louis University Bush Student Center, which is just a few blocks from us here in Grand Center. It's free and open to the public. If you'd like more information, go to stlpublicradio.org to the Cityscape page, and we'll have a link to more information. This is St. Louis Public Radio. Tony Kushner, just briefly, a little retrospective on your life. You were born in New York. Your parents were musicians. Were they professional?
Yes, my father was a Juilliard-trained clarinetist, and my mother was a trained at the Eastman Conservatory as a bassist. He played in various orchestras around the country, and eventually, when I was 2 years old, we moved to Lake Charles, Louisiana. He became the first clarinet and then ultimately the conductor of the Lake Charles Symphony, and when he retired at the age of 82, he was still conductor of the Lake Charles Symphony. It was a wonderful small orchestra, and my mother recorded with Stravinsky, and she was a bassist of City Opera, as my father was. Also, she played with Sabbath Wells, and was a really great bassoonist, and also played as the first bassoon of the Lake Charles Symphony until she died in 1990.
Now, I know you moved to New York, I think it was right after high school, to go to college. That had to be a deal changer for you.
What do you mean, a deal changer?
Well, do you think you'd be Tony Kushner, the playwright, screenwriter, if you hadn't moved to New York?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. I can't imagine not having come to New York. I mean, I applied to the University of Chicago, and I didn't get in. So I did get into Columbia. And, I certainly would never have remained in Louisiana. I'm very happy that I spent my first, from the age of 2 to the age of 17 there. I think it changed me in a lot of ways and had a big impact on me, but I don't think I would have stayed in Louisiana. And I was already very interested in theater. I didn't major in it in college. I don't think actually that people should major in theater in college. But I came to New York at a really great time when there was in the early 1970s, there was an enormous amount of very exciting theater being done. And I certainly learned an immense amount and became very excited about theater as a college student, just going to see plays. And took a couple of courses at Columbia, especially one in about a Shakespeare course, two semesters taught by Edward Taylor, who was a resident Shakespeare scholar at Columbia at the time, and that was a transformative experience. So, yeah, it's hard to say, that your life would turn out the same way if you hadn't done the same things that you did that got you to where you are. I think it was inevitable that I come to New York. If you're interested in theater, if you're interested in working as a person in theater, it's hard not to be in a big city. And the bigger the better, because theater and most of the arts depend on a degree of population density. Once you get going and become experienced in your craft, you may make the decision, if you can do it, to move to a farm, in the middle of wherever, and work in isolation. But in your early years, when you're really an apprentice and trying to figure out how to do these things, I think it's very important that you're surrounded by other people trying to do it. And some, if you're a poet, you can basically write on your own, and you will write on your own. If you're a playwright or a theater director or actor, obviously you have to be where there are other people doing the work, because it's a social form. It depends on other practitioners and also on an audience that is smart and demanding and seasoned. The theater capital of the United States has been and still is, in my opinion, New York City, and so that's where I went.
Well, we're so delighted that you're going to be visiting us again when the St. Louis University Library Associates present you with the 2012 St. Louis Literary Award. And that's going to be next Tuesday. Again, go to our website if you'd like to know more information. Tony Kushner, thanks so much for taking the time from L.A. to join us today. It's been an honor talking to you.
Well, a pleasure talking to you.
Coming up next on Cityscape, Federico Barocci and the St. Louis Art Museum, and later, Third Degree Glass Factory celebrates a decade with a party tonight. This is St. Louis Public Radio.